Welcome to Thor's Hour of Thunder, where we discuss that very large cross-section of everything that is both geeky and awesome.
Holla.
This is Thor slash Danny, and I'm here with People Magazine's 2011 Sexiest Man at a School.
Ball of the Brave. Yeah, I know. Take it. Oh, I'm doing a little pose. You can't see it because we're in Radio Land, but that's okay.
Though to be fair, it was Sexiest Man at a School with a long-nosed mammal as their mascot. So you did win a very specific category, but you still beat out, I think, Trent Reznor, who founded his own school called the Elephants just to try and win, to finally win something.
Wait, so do I get, like, was I in contention with people at, like, what is it, Alabama with the Crimson Tide, where it's kind of like a menstruation joke, but for some reason their mascot's an elephant? I still don't get that. I'm going to be honest with you.
Speaking of things crimson,
this is our special Valentine's Day episode, so we are going to talk about things like crimson, like the human heart, which is actually a muscle and has nothing to do with producing emotions. So, number one, I just want to rant and say that Valentine's Day is bullshit for that reason. Because what the hell do I want to send hearts, especially candy hearts, or hearts filled with chocolate candy, to someone if the heart has nothing to do with emotions? Why can't I just send a brain? Why can't I send a brain-shaped box of chocolates?
That would be a lot more volume of chocolate, too, because it would be three-dimensional as opposed to a flat, one-layered box. So people are getting gypped on chocolate. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've always liked Valentine's Day because I've never been with anyone who considered it a big deal. Like, it's sort of like, you know, I've always been with, like, pretty chill people. And it's sort of like, you know, it's nice. I like going ice skating for it. That's what I like to do. It's February. It's cold. You know, I like just being like, oh, good. It's time to go on a date, you know? Like, you know, that's – but I'm just sappy like that.
You are sappy like that. Let me tell you why you are incorrect, because I find it an incredibly alienating holiday for people with both within and without relationships. Okay, so number one, think about this. There are some people out there that you know, they want to do like one big deal thing for their significant other. And sometimes, you know, yeah, and there's absolutely an appropriate time for that one big, grand, lovely gesture, right? It's called your anniversary. And at that point, you know, it's like, oh, let me just remind you just how wonderful and important you are in my life. And then you have that, and then there's like this corporately mandated one, which says, oh, yeah, so whatever you did on your anniversary, you have to do something like that for this. But you can't do it, you know, as big. You have to do kind of like a light version of it, because, you know, you probably can't afford two grand gestures per year. So it alienates the people within the relationship. Outside the relationship, it's like, oh, look, hey, here's a holiday for an exclusive subset of the population. For the rest of you, too damn bad. It's like, why can't, well, you know, it's like, it's as if we declared like a ginger day. Like, okay, so today is the day that we celebrate people with red hair. And if you have red hair, you have to do it, because if you don't, there's something wrong with you, because you're not celebrating the fact that you're ginger. Or if you're outside and you're not ginger, today is the day for you to reflect upon the fact that you are not, and you should feel bad about that.
You know, I'd never thought of it that way. That's a very good point. See, I guess, yeah, to me, it's more like there's so much, like, Valentine's Day backlash at this point. Like, I hear way more people ranting about how much they hate Valentine's Day than the other way around. So in my typical sort of, like, you know, being contrarian, you know, I hope I don't just do it for the sake of being contrarian, but I oftentimes...
Well, like, I'm doing it for the sake of being contrarian, so...
Okay, well, you're in L.A. now, man. Everyone's... It's all a love fest out there. There's everyone's being fake nice to each other all the time. I live in New York, man. So... And I'm from D.C., where people... Like, at least people in New York are honest to each other. People in D.C. are just fake mean to each other, no matter their true emotions.
How do you fake mean? I'm slapping you in the face, but deep down in my heart, I think you're my favorite person in the world.
Oh, well, dude, you know half of those congressmen want to, you know, be getting it on
with each other.
Yeah, man. Look at, did you see the congressional date night? That's what they called it too. That was for the, the State of the Union, where they had the rival congressmen sit next to each other, and they had like, you know.
So are you suggesting that what we think is the State of the Union address is actually Congress's secret speed dating evening?
It was this year. This was the first year ever that they broke, you know, they normally have people sit on opposite sides of the aisle, quote unquote, which is a joke anyway, because Congress isn't structured that way. It changes, you know, they don't have, like, the seats can't move based on, you're going to be sitting with people who aren't your party anyway, you know, like, it's only three big sections. But the point was, they didn't have all on left and right. They had them all mixed together. Like, you know, to be, because of that, the tragic events with the you know, congresswoman who was shot and, you know, debilitated.
Right.
Yeah. They had this, like, one moment where they're like, we're going to pretend that we aren't terrible human beings. And they had, like, John Kerry sitting next to John McCain, which the Daily Show said the rest of Congress forced them to sit together because they were sick of them reciting their own State of the Union speeches under their breath.
Oh, I love it. The best strategy in these cases is always to, you know, seat Congress like you're seating people at a wedding. Whereas, you know, you want the right combination at the table, where it's some people that are familiar with each other, some people that are strangers. So, you know, we'll all make new friends that night.
Man, that's why that sounds way too complicated. That's why I'm gonna like push really hard to have my wedding at the Rock and Roll McDonald's.
It's a Rock and Roll McDonald's?
Yeah, it's a three-story.
I thought you were going to say Rock and Roll Hall of Fame there for a minute, and I was like, that'd be pretty badass, actually. Yeah.
No, that would be the. Well, actually, no, I, what museum would I go to if I had enough money to have like a big, crazily stupid reception? Like, not necessarily for a wedding, because I wouldn't want it to be about me. But if I was going to throw like the party to end all parties, you know, I would probably have it in that new giant Dulles Air and Space facility.
I would have it at the Louvre and use the wedding as an excuse to steal the Mona Lisa.
I'm amazed they haven't made a movie about that dude who stole the Mona Lisa back in the day. And then I found out the way he stole it is they were doing construction and the door was locked and he was a construction worker there. And he had the Mona Lisa in his hand and he like asked the guy, like, he's like, hey, can you unlock this door?
Oh, goodness gracious me. Oh, that would make a good movie, though.
Yeah, because it would have to be like starring Seth Rogen. Like, it wouldn't be a heist movie. It would be just like
just accidentally, like, oh, I stole the Mona Lisa. I don't know how I did it. I don't know how to give it back without getting in trouble.
Yeah, well, I think he went to Italy. He was an Italian like construction worker, which you know, talk about a stereotype.
Was he one of the Super Mario Brothers?
Yeah. All Italians before 1950 were either construction workers or plumbers. If it hadn't been for Al Pacino, there would be no Italians in any other job. Those movies, like, people are like, oh, man, and Justice for All, that Al Pacino movie where he plays a lawyer in the 70s, they're like, man, that's not a very good movie. It's really over the top. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. That was like the Guess Who's Coming for Dinner for Italian people. That was as a grandson of a Carini. That was like, look, Italians can do things besides being plumbers and construction workers.
Oh my god. Oh, speaking of over the top ones, have you ever seen the Nicolas Cage vampire movie where he's like over the top the entire time?
Oh, I vaguely heard about this in just one of those many articles about like Nicolas Cage, you know, best worst actor, you know, like
it's Vampire's Kiss is the name of the movie. And if you haven't
seen
it,
the band Kiss?
No, I mean, that would be, you know, even more over the top. But it's one of those things where it's Nicolas Cage running around just screaming. Just screaming.
Some of these I feel
like... Why don't you leave me alone?
He was... Speaking of movies everyone should watch on Valentine's Day, he was awesome in Bad Lieutenant. And that's a nice romance, because it proves that no matter how coked up you are, if you can get a hooker off of, you know, the many, many charges she's on, even if she's really hot and played by Eva Mendes, she'll still sleep with you.
You know, that movie, The Port of Call in New Orleans, it's just a lovely movie, but I'm still kind of confused about the whole issue of Herzog saying that he never saw the original Bad Lieutenant. even though I'm pretty certain that the film was probably not sold by Herzog this way, but like the people that did sell the film to the studio said like, oh yeah, it's like a remake of this Bad Lieutenant movie from like the from the '80s. And Herzog didn't know that they sold it this way, and he's like, I've never seen that movie. It's like, I just made up this title on my own. It's like, oh yeah, it'd be just like a police detective that's like addicted to drugs. Yeah, why? I was the first one to think about this.
I like that his next movie is going to be called Bad Robot, and he's going to be really pissed when that production company sues him, when J.J. Abrams is like, what?
I think he's got his Herzog's movie's next movie is going to be like a reboot of Godzilla, and he's going to be like, I've never heard of any sort of movie about a radioactive dinosaur breathing fire.
It's going to be Godzilla Port of Call New Orleans.
Godzilla Port of Call Tokyo Drift. It's actually not going to be a monster movie. It's going to be a driving movie about a man who's horribly scarred to the point of looking like a reptile.
Or it'd be also good if they just got that actor who who's the actor in the Godzilla suit forever for like 30 years.
Oh god, his name's escaping me right now.
He's in that stop motion video I did in college. There's like no pictures of him on the internet. I'd use the worst picture ever for him. But it would be great if it was just him still in the same Godzilla suit, just in a car. Like they just make like, you know, like if Fast Five, the new Fast and the Furious movie, if one of the like random racers in that was just Godzilla and they don't address it, they just call him some other name, you know, like, hey, Bruno Sanchez, come over here and help me with this wrench. He's roar.
Oh, I know his name is Haru Nakajima.
There we are.
He also played Rodan and Mothra in other movies, but then when he had to like be Godzilla and fight them, they had to cast new people. But otherwise, they would always go to him first.
It'd be great if there was a scene that was just him in the Godzilla outfit, and then like he had one glove off, and he was like holding the Mothra outfit and trying to manipulate it at the same time.
It's like, why are you punching yourself, Mothra? Why are you punching yourself?
Yes. So in honor of Valentine's Day, we were going to discuss the comic book relationships and their lack of, shall we say, realism. If you're not a 12-year-old boy.
Well, I mean, if you're a 12-year-old boy, it's not really a matter of realism because you've never had a real relationship yet. You, it's sort of confirming your fantasies, saying that, oh yeah, this could possibly happen, and then you get jaded when it doesn't. So let me ask you this question, Thor, God of Thunder, what is the comic book relationship that you buy as like a well written and thought through one, and which one do you think is the worst? Thought through worst written one.
See, it's tough because I only read really crappy comics that no one cares about. For those of you who are just tuning in for this, our fourth podcast, I mostly read Peter David's run on X-Factor and Hulk and Aquaman. I got into comics through Peter David's Aquaman, so he'll always be my go-to guy, but he doesn't really do as much relationships as he does like short relationships that go terribly, which I like because I feel like that's so much more realistic. Like, the run where, cause like if you're having these like a million year long, like, or these characters that don't age and stuff, like why would they're in so much stuff? They're not, unless it's like, unless the relationship's established before the comic starts, because then I buy it. You're like, then you just have to show like a loving couple, you know. But if they like fall in love in the comic the way all of them do, like you're not there's no way to like portray. It's so hard to portray romance well. I think that's the hardest. That's why it's always shitty romantic comedies or movies to release, because like romantic dramas are so hard to do. There's so some good ones will leap to mind soon, but like there's so few like actual like good like romances. And obviously comics don't put that in the forefront. They don't hire writers who are good at that. So I liked the relationship between Madrix and Siren/New Banshee.
Oh yeah,
because it was, you know, he knocked her up, And it was so, like, it was very much sort of this, like, well, wow, like, we're so excited for this kid coming into the world. And it was just a very, it had a lot of interesting elements to it. And then, like, you know, later when she got to, she was so pissed at him, and then, like, evil Jamie from the future came, and she's like, thank you so much, Jamie, for coming back evil and robotic so I can murder you.
Okay, so this is a question I have. It's like, oh, he came back? I thought he died of the legacy virus, like, back in the 90s. What happened there?
Oh, that was bullshit. That was after Peter David had left the X-Factor run. That was, like, right when he'd left, and they were trying to, like, keep that as a comic, you know? Because, like, the X-Factor was David's, like, he's, like, you know, the whole, it was originally, you know, they, obviously they had the original X-Men on it. And then once they decided to make it a spinoff title without primary X-Men characters, that was David. They were like, hey, you can make, you know, spin straw into gold. He's like the Josh Whedon of that kind of stuff. It's like, hey, can you take this awful time slot and these awful elements and make something awesome? And he's like, yeah, I can do that. I have a very high opinion of Peter David. Feel free to contradict me.
That's fine. No. I mean, I always like the premise of X-Factor, that it's like, oh, like, what if the X-Men worked for the Fed?
Yeah.
What would that possibly look like?
Yeah. It was a fun premise, and the like liaison they had, who was very much like the, you know, the gruff police chief in like a lot of
Dirty Harry comics.
Oh, I forget, she's blonde. She showed up again in she blackmailed Madrix into doing some stuff in I haven't read X-Factor in like a year or so, but she, like 2 years ago, she blackmailed him.
Oh,
yeah, she's a cool character because she's, and yet again, a pretty like realistic character. Like, she's not, you know, she's not like a Nick Fury style character, but she's not like, you know, corrupt politician. She's sort of just someone who wants to get her job done, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm still like blanking on her name, which is kind of bothering me because I used to read these. Val Cooper. Val Cooper is her name.
Wait. Alice Cooper?
Val Cooper.
Valis Cooper?
Yes.
Valis.
Who is responsible for one of the greatest episodes of The Muppet Show, I just want to say.
Oh my god. If you are listening and you haven't seen Alice Cooper on The Muppet Show, find it on BitTorrent or, you know, the internet. Or if you're one of them fancy Frenchmen, buy the DVD. It's fantastic.
I have the DVD and I'm not French, Danny.
Yeah, but I'm even more of a geek, and I downloaded all of them because Disney didn't buy the rights to all the songs. I think they bought the rights to all the Alice Cooper songs, because otherwise there wouldn't have been an episode. But like, yeah, the Vincent Price episode of season one of The Muppet Show, they cut out him singing You've Got a Friend, which, remind me, I should put that on at the end of the podcast. Like, just use, you know, it's fair use because it's like the podcast has the same rules as radio, if we're playing it as a, you know, promotion of a song rather than as a theme song. Too much information. Is the Vincent Price singing?
You can't sue us, is what we're just saying.
Vincent Price, we know you're listening. You can't sue us.
Can you hear us, Vincent? Yes, Sean and Danny, I can hear you.
Yes. Oh, thank you. That was fantastic. Have you heard his version of You Got a Friend on the pipe organ?
No, I haven't, actually, which makes me a bad person, but that's okay. Vincent Price was a bad person, right?
Was he?
I don't know. He played villains so often.
Normally, people who play villains, I've found most interviews I've read with, like, people talking about, like, classic Hollywood villains, they said, like, you know, Lon Chaney Jr., like, pretty much everyone except for, you know, like, they said Bela Lugosi was on too much smack to know what the hell was going on, but everyone else, all the villains were all just the classiest guy in the room, and they were just, like, they were, you know, like we were talking about in the previous episode, they were so good at doing anything that they ended up playing villains, you know? Like, they were the best actor in the room, you know? And they
so
were,
what about Christopher? What about Lord Christopher Lee?
He's supposed to be really cool. He and Peter Cushing were apparently like just inseparable. Like they're both married. Like I don't think that was like, you know, I don't think they, not that there were anything wrong if they were gay, because I thought they were at first just by his eulogy for Peter Cushing, or not even eulogy. I think it was just a statement to the press. He was just like, I will never.
Chris really came out of his house one day, like crying, and just started talking to anyone who would listen about how much he loved Peter Cushing.
Yeah, no, he literally said, like, you think about, like, moving on, and, like, you know, your friends and family, he said, but I don't think I'll ever. Like, I'll have to look up the quote sometime, but I don't feel like doing it right now. But it was pretty much, you know, like, you know, pretty much I will never be as happy as I was hanging out with Peter Cushing on the Hammer Horror movies. Like, he was my best friend. Sweet. I wish that it was like now where they made documentaries about every movie they're making. Because can you imagine how cool it would be to just see an hour of footage of just Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, like, playing chess and drinking and fighting, you know?
Okay, so two things. Number one, it's nice that they kind of had this connection.
Rad bromance.
They had a bromance, and they have like this interesting Star Wars connection, right? So Cushing was in the original run, and then Lee sort of becomes, a replacement for Cushing in a sense that, like, oh, he's this like the second tier big bad guy.
Yeah.
In the prequel run.
And God, yeah, as much as I love Alec Guinness, Peter Cushing is the best actor in the first Star Wars movie, I think, far and away. I think the parts that, like, make that movie are James, James Earl Jones. Jones's. James Franco. I kept wanting to say
James Franco. Oh, my.
New so Goblin.
Here's where I say, like, I have nothing but fear and dread about Lucas doing more to the Star Wars films, because I wouldn't put it past him if he put James Franco in it.
James Earl Jones out. James Franco now doing the voice of Darth Vader. James Franco doing his Pineapple Express voice. Oh, and have you seen how he's getting like 4 simultaneous masters and teaching a course? A friend of me and Charlotte's, me and Sif. How is it supposed to be pronounced? The
Lady
Charlotte's
Sif.
Sif?
S-I-F.
Okay, yeah, a friend of me and Sif's, that's Thor's girlfriend, Sean just informed me a second ago, our friend Christina, who liked our first update of the podcast, so we should, thank you, Christina Huang, if you're listening, we love you. If you're not listening, we still love you. Sean's dancing for you, but you can't see it because it's radio.
It's the magic of radio.
Yes, but yeah, so
I can do whatever I want, and you can't see me, but you can just tell from the sound of my voice that I'm having the time of my life.
Sean said that, and then immediately put 2 beers in his mouth in 2 straws. I kid you not, folks. He lives every week like a shark week. So anyway, because he was telling me about all the douchey like anti-academic stuff. Basically, James Franco is just enrolled in like every like he's enrolled at Yale, Columbia, and NYU right now, and he doesn't show up in any of the classes. He has a secretary who takes notes, and they all gave him degrees. He already got a degree from Columbia, and then he's pretty much just like, I guess if he was doing this and like was making public statements about like, I'm doing this to like invalidate, to show that like these places will let me in just because I'm rich, but no, he just wants like cred. He wants to be like, look, I have a master's and a PhD. And it's like, no, you don't. Like, you don't, man. You have a secretary who writes your papers for you. And the one thing he submitted a paper to Esquire, a creative writing essay, that literally, like, if I'd written that in high school, I would have, like, gotten, like, a D-. It was so bad. But he's going to be in the new Star Wars. You heard it in your first book. Star Wars 3D starring James Franco in every role.
I mean, okay, so what would you think they would, like, unfortunately do with James Franco? So I have a sinking suspicion that they would, you know, cover up Mark Hamill with James Franco.
Oh, for all the post Mark Hamill's injuries scenes.
Yeah,
just replace him with
I got mauled by a Wampa, and now I'm James Franco.
And they should just have him act like his Pineapple Express character the whole time.
Oh, that would be weird though for the Yoda scenes, because Yoda looks like is acting like he's high all the time. So it'd be like, I'd have a new interpretation of what that swamp gas in Dagobah
did in. Yes. Oh, but yeah, what were you saying about Spider-Man and Mary Jane, especially in the 80s when they were
So let me give you my answer to this. So I think the best written comic book relationship right now is Cyclops and Emma Frost.
The chick who is what's his name, the really really fast guy, Quicksilver, it's his sister?
No, that's Scarlet Witch. Scarlet Witch married the Vision. Emma Frost is the White Queen of the Hellfire Club that reformed, joined the X-Men, and ended up being Cyclops's girlfriend. And there was a bit of an overlap between the time when Cyclops was married to Jean Grey and when he started hooking up with Emma. Okay, so here's why it's accurate, because it's accurate to just how inaccurate the sort of long-term realities of these characters in comic books are. So Cyclops hasn't aged, really. I mean, maybe he's aged 10 years since the 60s. and the thing is, all that time he was kind of in with Jean Grey, right? So Jean
don't
Grey,
they have a future baby?
Yeah, they well, no, they don't have a future baby. So there was originally Cyclops and Jean Grey, and they loved each other, and blah blah blah. And then Claremont in the great rebirth of the X-Men run, where he did like the Phoenix Saga and the Dark Phoenix Saga, he killed off Jean Grey. He killed off like the main love interest because he was like, look, this is, you know, these relationships don't go on forever, and these characters should be able to go on forever. So I should be able to destroy Jean Grey and then have have something new to do with Cyclops, right? So what they do is they reintroduce a new character, Madeline Pryor, who's a clone of Jean Grey.
Who's a clone of Richard Pryor.
Well, she's the daughter of Richard Pryor, but the clone of Jean Grey. So Mr. Sinister cloned Jean Grey and then gave her to Richard Pryor to raise in Alaska. She was raised by Richard Pryor and a polar bear. So, you know, Ebony and Ivory living together in harmony. So, I mean, it was a great statement, I think, to the culture of the time. Because it's like, look, Richard Pryor and a polar bear can have a relationship because a polar bear is, you know, white fur on the outside but black skin on the inside.
Are they really?
Yes, it's a fact. Look it up.
If you shaved National a polar bear? Dude, that would be like an awesome like polar bear espionage movie where it's like, okay, I gotta go undercover, and they shave him and he looks like a black bear.
Yes. Okay, so I'm getting off track here. So yeah, so
no, that
so
never ever happens to us, man. What are you talking about?
There's a clone Jean Grey, and she marries Cyclops, and Cyclops for some reason doesn't realize that, oh my god, you look exactly like Jean Grey, like entirely like Jean Grey, like the same birthmarks that Jean Grey has. Because I'm Cyclops, I actually know about her strange birthmarks. It doesn't like dawn on him, and then they have a future baby.
Oh,
and the baby gets like diseased and has to go to the future and comes back as Cable. But then Madeline Pryor goes crazy when she realizes that she's a clone, and then sells her soul to Satan, and then she becomes the Queen of Hell. And then Jean Grey comes back from the dead. Well, she doesn't come back from the dead as much as she wasn't dead before, because when the Phoenix, there's like the Phoenix Force, which is an alien thing that created another clone of Jean Grey, and we saw the other clone of Jean Grey get killed, and the real Jean Grey was like. So at this point, it's just getting so bizarre. Like, we had this very poignant moment of a man losing his high school sweetheart, right? And this was like, oh, it was going to affect him forever. And then the fact that, like, look, we can't deal with inventing new characters and giving up old characters in the comic world, that we have to invent this convoluted, insane scenario.
It is like a soap opera that way.
To make it so that we don't have to give up any of the main characters. And I mean, okay, so speaking as a writer who has written some things in the superhero genre before, and
besides slash fiction.
Well, okay, so I'm talking about like the radio drama that was the glory, that was The Shadow, and I mean I couldn't...
That was kind of slash fiction. This is what we did for our college radio station, for those of you listening who are not John Nappy.
So yeah, but I mean, like, it's a hard time giving up certain characters. Like, I tried to kill off Margot, and I just brought her back. You know, every villain gets killed off in a comic book and come back. You know, I did that too.
And this segues directly into Human Torch. You said they changed the name, right? Like I said, I've been not really paying attention to this because it's off, but even the Fantastic Four anymore, right?
Let me finish my point about like the Cyclops relationship.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So yeah, these convoluted things with Jean Grey, and eventually they get rid of Jean Grey permanently, like maybe 5 years ago, where they just killed her off finally, permanently. And in the interim, Cyclops started having an affair with Emma Frost, who was the White Queen, was one of the X-Men's nemesis that was reformed, and she was, you know, joining the team. And it's actually kind of poignant in the sense of you've got in like culture like, oh, it either matters, you know, it doesn't just matter what you do, it matters about like what you think, what your intentions are, right? So if you could just like mentally project your sexual fantasies out into another person's mind, and they could project their into yours, and they kind of like matched up, that would consist in an affair, right? Even though you don't actually get laid.
I'm much too aroused right now to speak.
Well, I mean, it's the point here. So it's the thought that counts, right? Isn't that the take-home message of Valentine's Day? It's the thought that counts. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to give you a box of chocolates that's in the shape of heart. I can give you a box of chocolates in the shape of a brain. And it's the thought that counts because I was thinking about, you know, where the emotions really are coming from. So I wanted to give you a brain of chocolate, not a heart of chocolate. And you should appreciate me for thinking, even though it's like this is horrific and it's like it's a gross little brain box filled with chocolate and it's not really appealing at all. But still, the thought that counts. So Cyclops has this like mental affair with Emma Frost. And in the end, after Jean Grey dies, they hook up. And the best part about this is it's the first time in comics I think that the female is alpha.
That's cool.
You know? That it's not so much, you know, what Cyclops cares about and he's like, oh, I need to protect you and you need to do what I say. It's this, you know, Emma Frost is this manipulative thing who's honestly like taking control of this man's life. And there's emotions there, but it's always like, no, it's I'm in control. You're some guy with some strange glasses. And oh, God, but guy with strange glasses. So here's another thing that like, kind of pissed me off about comic book relationships. This sort of fetishizing nerd fantasies. So
yeah, I mean, I obviously get from a marketing standpoint why they would think like, but I feel like it's the same idea. That's the same, you know, lack of creativity that thinks like, oh, children only want to see live action movies about little kids doing stuff. When I was a kid, I shied away. I wanted to watch, you know, Indiana Jones, Back to the Future, movies about people who, you know, Michael J. Fox was an adult for all intents and purposes. He's in adult situations, even though he's supposed to be a high schooler. You know, like, yeah. Those are the movies I liked. Like, I feel like movies about, like, you know, like, that's one of the problems I have with Harry Potter, is very, very well-written books. The last couple movies have had great cinematography, great acting, but, you know, I just don't care about, like, this world is so amazing, and then they only talk about what's going on at a school. Like, any other part of Harry Potter would be more interesting than the part at the school. So, like, if you wrote a book about, like, Hagrid or, like, Sirius or anything like that. But so that's my problem with comic books, is that they do the same thing, where it's like, the way with kids' movies, they're like, oh, kids only want to read about little kids doing stupid crap. They think, like, oh, like, if we're going to have Peter Parker, you know, like, Peter Parker made sense because he was supposed to be, he actually was dealing with high school problems, but when they're like, when they have these guys with alter egos, it's, you know, where they're super cool in every other way, but then they're like, but look, he needs glasses and he falls down. And it, like Clark Kent, like why in the, as much as I love the Superman movies with, Christopher Reeve, why is he such a dork in that? Like, what is to be gained by being like, look guys, dorks are secretly awesome. You know, like, it just seems like it's the same deal, you know?
Well, okay, so comic books, I guess, are supposed to be telling us not what life is supposed to be like, or what it really is like, but it's supposed to be this possibility of like, oh, here's like an alternate world where, you know, things that you wish would happen do happen. But I mean, I think that's okay. I mean, it's supposed to be escapist, but the thing is, it has to obey rules to a certain degree that make it relevantly similar to our own world. So, and I'm thinking in the case of Spider-Man, Peter Parker, he, like, most of his relationships have been him either sort of awkwardly failing to get the girl, and
with
the girl
with chicks,
like,
who don't know that he's Spider-Man, so they're way out of his league. See, that's the thing, is that's what I feel like it shouldn't be the norm, like, you know, to play into the fantasy. Like, why can't I get that it's supposed to be wish fulfillment, but why can't it be wish fulfillment with some sort of, you know, interesting development where, like, oh, he doesn't get the girl because he's a pizza delivery boy, you know?
Yeah. So here's the thing. I think this is why Mary Jane doesn't work, but unfortunately Gwen Stacy always did.
Why unfortunately? I don't know much about Gwen Stacy other than the fact that Ron Howard's daughter is hot.
Well, okay, so yeah, fair enough. But I mean, okay, so let's consider some of the Peter Parker girlfriends. The original one was Betty Brant, the secretary at the Daily Bugle, played by Elizabeth Banks in the Spider-Man Raimi movies. Oh my God, she's so beautiful.
Elizabeth Banks is so funny too. Like, if you ever watch her in interviews and stuff, like, she's normally, like, on, like, 30 Rock, like, I would say she's funnier than the dialogue she's given on 30 Rock. Like, she's just awesome.
So you get Betty Brant, you've got Gwen Stacy, you've got Mary Jane, and let's just throw in for shits and giggles the Black Cat. You're familiar with the Black Cat?
Yeah. That's in all the, like I said, I've read Maximum Carnage, and then I have the build up to Carnage. I've got more for a collecting thing. I managed to get on the cheap, the first ever, you know, where Carnage appears on the last page. I got for like $1 with like, you know, like with 10 other issues. So the ones leading up to that are the one with the Kingpin trying to like save his wife. He like puts her into a coma, you know. So the black, there's this scene that I think typifies what we're, you know, part Peter Parker's relationships, where, you know, the Black Cat at this point knows that he's Spider-Man, Mary Jane knows he's Spider-Man, and Mary Jane shows up and like Peter Parker just got like beat up to shit. And the Black Cat's there, like, because he's dying. And Mary Jane says up, and she's like, oh, what were you doing last night? And it's this whole other end of, like I said, about not having any sort of, like, interesting twist in the running. It's like, well, oh, my God, a jealous girlfriend. Like, dude, couldn't it, like, why wouldn't it be interesting to have, like, a realistic character? Like, why does she just have to be like, oh my God, why? Like, every Spider-Man I've ever read is Peter Parker being like, Mary Jane, I gotta go save stuff. And she's like, but you promised me we'd go fishing. He's like, but everyone on Earth will die. And she's like, I hate you. And then like 5 years later, she's like, oh, I'm sorry, Peter. It's okay that you couldn't go fishing. And he's like, I'm in a coma.
Okay, so number one, I want to mention that here's a little interesting tidbit about Black Cat. So she was introduced into Spider-Man comics in the 70s, right? And you think immediately, oh, chicken likes like a skin tight outfit named after a cat. Oh, she's clearly just a ripoff of Catwoman, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's wrong, actually. So originally Catwoman was, okay, a much more conservative character, right? So she wore like long skirts. And it really didn't have much of a like the typical Catwoman costume that we expect today, right? the Batman Returns Michelle Pfeiffer outfit. No, that wasn't what she originally was. And actually, Black Cat predates Catwoman with the skin tight sort of like vinyl vamp kind of outfit.
Can I just say I'm glad we live in an age of, you know, sexual equality and post-feminism where I can watch Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns.
Oh, such a great movie, just yeah. In general. I mean, Danny DeVito was born to play that role. And I mean, like, I don't mean that in the sense that, like, he's a midget and midgets should play midgets. But, I mean, he did a good job with the rest of it. I mean, it wasn't all about him being ugly and short, even though that was most of the role.
Yeah. No, Danny DeVito is an amazing actor. I think the best quote I've ever read about Danny DeVito is from Roger Ebert, who's a very skilled writer. I don't agree with him most of the time, but I think that shows how good of a writer he is that I'll still read his reviews even if I'm like, man, you totally missed this. So he was talking about like Ruthless People or something, and he said the key to Danny DeVito is that if you watch any scene he's in, he doesn't seem short. He takes such command of every scene he's in that he makes, no matter what movie he's in, he makes everyone else in the room seem too tall, seem awkward, because he makes them put their face down to talk to him. He makes himself like the beacon of power.
Yeah, I kind of buy that. Now that I'm like reviewing all the Danny DeVito movies and TV shows that I've seen in my time, yeah, that's true. It's you don't notice just how short he is. Unless there's like a shot designed for showing you that, and they usually don't, because why would you need to do that?
Yeah, no, he's awesome. But yeah, so sorry, I keep interrupting and ranting about Spider-Man. We need to get the expert's opinion here.
Okay, so we've got possible relationships, and what's like the one thing that is common to all these relationships for Peter Parker? Reel me that.
I would say, like, going back to sort of some of my complaints, is that they're totally, they don't exist, they never write a relationship for him. They write a, like, sort of seduction and then conflict, you know, that's like, oh, wow.
That's exactly right, because it he never really wins the girl. The girl always sort of shows interest in him. And it's always like, oh, hey, oh, I have no, you know, you're completely out of my league. Why are you talking to me? oh, this is really hard, because it would be very easy for me to just be like, oh, I just accept this like adoration by some girl who's out of my league, and oh, it's great. But no, this is okay, so now I'm thinking that maybe this does make sense. So the whole idea of Spider-Man is he has too much to do in his life, right? He's trying to live two lives, and the two lives are always making the other one harder. So him being Spider-Man makes him being Peter Parker harder. Him being Peter Parker makes him being Spider-Man harder. Like, yeah, responsibilities conflict. And the issue with this is like, oh, here seems to be a completely easy scenario. Ridiculously hot redhead who's like, oh, let's go on a date tonight. Like telling this nerd guy with like glasses, oh, we're going on a date tonight? Okay, yes, I guess so. and that should be easy, right? That should, you know, no problems. But yet it does because of the Spider-Man premise. So I think in talking through this, I think this actually makes sense.
Yeah, but I think that's what would be interesting, and that's what I faulted for, is that the premise doesn't become, oh, wow, like, because the idea of, like, having to put, you know, your responsibilities above your lusts is a very interesting goal and a very classical theme, you know, but I don't feel like that's what happens in Spider-Man. I feel like too often it becomes people getting angry at him for things he can't prevent, which is just lazy writing. Like, that's why the problem I have with Spider-Man is most of his personal life stuff involves just people getting pissed at him for stuff he has no control over, you know?
Okay, so that's fair enough. But yeah. One thing I'm going to say, though, is I think the Gwen Stacy storyline is probably the best relationship he had. And I might be basing this on partly, I think it was, okay, who wrote Spider-Man immediately after Stan Lee?
Oh, I'm sorry, man. I don't know. You want me to riff for a minute while you Google it?
Yeah, riff for a minute while I Google this.
Yeah,
Spider-Man.
Well, let me briefly state that in you know anticipation of what we'll be talking about when we finish this is you know Spider-Man at one point was in the Fantastic Four with Wolverine, and I think the other two characters were the Trix Rabbit and Oscar the Grouch and
Ghost Rider and the Hulk, not Oscar the Grouch.
At least I got the color scheme right. Ghost Rider, whitehead, Trix Rabbit, whitehead, Oscar the Grouch,
oh, dear
green.
God, you're right.
Oh my God, Trix Rabbit, Ghost Rider. Trix Rabbit with a rabbit skull, a flame.
Oh, this is just kind of creeping me out, man.
What's the answer? Did you see who wrote it?
Okay, I'm looking at it. It's like, okay, Ditko was the one that originally wrote it. And
Mike
then,
Ditka?
Yeah, Mike Ditka wrote it.
Dump ass.
Why do you think he, you know, Spider-Man fought a guy called the Grizzly? He's like, oh, we gotta put the bears in there. This character makes absolutely no sense, but whatever.
There were all various undertones about, the NFL season that year. He fought the Grizzly, and then that Vulture guy was originally called the Atlanta Falcon, but they had him tone it down.
Well, just the fact that the Rhino originally was called the Linebacker.
Oh, really?
No, absolutely not. It's completely retarded. Why would you think that?
Because you said it with such conviction.
Well, I generally do. Okay, so let me just bracket this question of who I'm talking about. Okay, so the people that originally wrote the Gwen Stacy character, or Mike Ditka, yeah. And there were the ones who recently reinterpreted the Gwen Stacy character, which was, of all people, Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, the writing duo that brought you
Long Halloween.
Batman recent ones, The Long Halloween and Long Halloween and Dark Victory. So you had,
and they also brought you. I actually have it right. Sorry to interrupt you, but I actually have over here one of my favorites of all time. As a man who's not big into the concept of Superman as a hero, Superman for All Seasons, about like him as just this goofy teenager, is brilliant. Both their writing and illustrations on Superman for All Seasons. But moving on.
Wonderful. So anyway, so yeah, so the Loeb and Sale kind of did a once over of the original Spider-Man Gwen Stacy stories in the I think the series was called Spider-Man Blue.
Oh yeah.
Which was good. So he was like on Valentine's Day, sort of. The convention was that like every Valentine's Day, Peter Parker goes up into the attic and he records some sort of testimonial to Gwen, like some sort of like prayer or speech or something to say like, oh, I'm just going to remember how we met and how, you know, how wonderful it was, even though how tragically it ended.
Does he give this to her or does he play it on a boombox in front of her house?
She's dead, Thor.
You didn't give me the timeline on this.
She's dead.
What? Okay, so help the guy out.
Like years later, it's like years later in remembering.
He was in the attic. I assumed he was a teenager masturbating to pictures of Gwen Stacy. When you hear attic and Peter Parker, isn't that the first thing you think of?
Either that or spandex. Wait, is there a difference? But yeah, and the issue was like these were like very. That they were ultimately very compatible. They had a lot of the same values. And the thing was, Gwen was just popular and Peter wasn't. They were just in two different social circles. So it actually made sense to sort of organic them coming together, which just wasn't there in any of the characters because no one ever wrote a character for Peter Parker, like even Mary Jane or Betty Brant that actually were... kind of like got him the way he was, like the science geek and just kind of the very interested in the world and just wanting to help other people. Nobody actually tried to make him a compatible match.
Yeah.
Everything was just sort of this, oh, here's like some hot girl who's giving him the time of day when they shouldn't.
Yeah.
And let's see what we can do with that.
Yeah. And I think that's like what major rants before and as a man who's much more of a movie geek than a comic book geek, like in the first Spider-Man movie, I remember, you know, the line where he's and Tobey Maguire's kind of putting on that really like obnoxious voice for that narration part where he's like, the girl I liked before I even liked girls, you know, for Mary Jane. And it's that whole idea. It's these sort of soap opera ideas where like love is this like concrete. It's like, oh, this is the girl I love. So it must be, it's like, no, that's not a relationship. Like, I feel like yet again, like me talking about how I feel like they're underestimating the readers that they think that they only want to see like, oh, I am a dude. So I want to see this like knight conquering things. And that's an easy story to write the guy getting the girl. But when you have an ongoing series, you can't just have, you know, it's not like Die Hard where I'm going to just bring that up. I think for every podcast from now on, because Die Hard applies to everything. It's not like Die Hard where look, he saved his marriage because, like, in the movie, that's what I love about Die Hard, is he's this kind of, like, fuck-up cop, and his wife just remembers why she loves him, because they have it starting out where they clearly had a good relationship, they both started putting work and everything else ahead of it, they remember why they love each other, and I love that because for the third movie, like, it's been a couple years, and his wife doesn't give a shit. Like, the big climax for the movie is that he decides to man up after all the stuff that happens to him and call his wife, you know? Even call her, because they're so estranged. And I feel like that's a cool way to have a relationship versus it being, like, if you're going to carry on a relationship, it shouldn't just be like, oh, look, Mary, like I was saying before, it shouldn't just be, oh, Mary Jane's mad because Peter missed the thing. It's like, you should be used to this by now. Like, it's like, there's definitely are ways within the scope of comics and within that level of writing to have real characters, because definitely people have done it, you know? Actually, Harley Quinn and the Joker in Batman the Animated Series.
Would you consider them compatible?
I thought it was a very... As a kid, I always thought that was the most interesting part of the show because they didn't really tone down the Joker to have him have a love interest. It wasn't like they didn't have to neuter him. She knew that he was psychotic, and that was like her appeal because she had the medical background, you know? She like liked the idea, like it was like the ultimate sort of S&M relationship, and it wasn't... Like they only had a couple of episodes that addressed it, but I felt like if those guys had... written, you know, like a thing focused on them as the protagonists, you would have saw interesting dynamic just with almost like, sort of almost like a Natural Born Killers kind of thing, or like Badlands, where it's like these two terrible people who work really well together as a couple, you know?
Okay, so, but, okay, I think the thing with Harley and the Joker is there's actually something more sadistic in Harley's end of the relationship than I think people are giving credit, because why does she adore the Joker and emulate him and go from, you know, law-abiding citizen to killer and thief to follow him? Well, because she's the one that supposedly was let in on the inner circle, like let into his mind, allowed to figure him out.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a power relationship that Quinn almost was turned on, I think, by the possibility of being the only person to have a certain power over the Joker, which is just to understand his origin. And even though we find out that it's like a lie, like the Joker lies to everyone.
Including
to Harley, that she wouldn't give up that fantasy. The fantasy that she gets the Joker better than anyone else. And because of that, she has almost like some sort of hand in the relationship, even though practically, no, it's always the Joker calling the shots. He's allowed to be abusive and she just kind of takes it. But the thing is, in her mind, she has something over him.
Yeah. Well, and it is hard. Like, I know you own the series. I haven't watched it since I was a kid. I was looking at some clips of it the other day, and it is hard, like looking at, you know, the jokes they do make about spousal abuse, are very, but I almost feel like because it was a kid's, it was very much, it wasn't like a comic book where it's like, oh, it's for, you know, it's a darker comic book. It was a children's television show, and I feel like without making it sort of too scary, it did, like, I shouldn't say they had... I'm sorry, I think before, I don't mean they had like a good relationship, but I feel like they had a very detailed, constructive relationship, you know? Like, they're two terrible people, and yes, it's very much, the S&M is all him just like completely abusing her, but I thought the like psychological profile is like of just, you know, it's just very complicated, you know, for a weekly action show.
Yeah, I don't know, I think that's... Well, I think that's why it was instantly translated into the comics.
Yeah.
Which was like, oh, this was actually a good idea to give someone some sort of inner perspective on the Joker. That even if it's like wrong, it's good because it gives the reader something else into the Joker, because everyone's interested in, you know, the Joker.
No, it's super cool. So yeah, I now know more about why I like the hot characters I like in comics than I did before.
Well, I'm glad that there's some value added in this whole process. Okay, so two things I want to make sure we talk about. One is Scarlet Witch and the Vision. What are your opinions?
Okay, yet again, the more and more of this podcast tends to be me not knowing characters. The Vision?
the Vision is a robot that was constructed by Ultron.
I like it already.
The major villains of the Avengers. Ultron was a robot originally created by Ant-Man and given like sentience and free will.
That
and
always Ultron turns out well.
Yeah, and so obviously Ultron goes crazy and tries to conquer the world, and then in one of his plots to conquer the world, he creates a robot called the Vision, who's got like mental patterns based on the original character Wonder Man. Some like old reformed villain turned Avenger who immediately died as soon as they used this in like the 60s. So Vision's got like this. The soul of a hero in him, but Ultron uses him to like fight the Avengers, and his powers I think are okay. So he's got like a laser beam that comes out of his forehead, and he can become intangible like Shadow Cat and pass through walls and stuff.
Sharks with freaking laser beams on their foreheads.
Well, he doesn't have a fin, but that would be kind of cool though. So anyway, so you get the Scarlet Witch, who's Magneto's daughter, falls in love with a robot. And I think one of the great Marvel reboots of the past 10 years was when Scarlet Witch, I think, like, realizes that, thinks she's had children with him, but her powers are such that she's like deceived herself to the point that she thinks that she's had children with them, but it's like, how could she possibly have children with a robot? And then she goes crazy when she realizes that she doesn't have children, and then she like blows up the world and creates like an alternate timeline.
Oh, that's what causes No More Mutants? That's what causes...
That was the House of M story.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was over Vision. That was over
Scarlet Witch and Vision.
Yeah, because that was... I sort of get in and out. I don't know, for whatever reason, I have like, you know, sort of like 8 month periods where I'm super into reading like all sorts of comics. And then, you know, like right now I haven't read a comic book in like 6 months or so. I was very much following during Civil War and then during House of M. That's cool. I like the idea of a robot with a soul because it brings back one of my favorite science fiction characters as a child was Data on Next Generation.
Oh yeah, I think there's got to be some sort of connections, at least in the minds of writers with that scenario.
Yeah, I mean, because it's great, the evolution of, like, the robot as the hero, I feel like for me, at least TV-wise, was, you know, B9 in Lost in Space. It was the first time I'd seen, like, the robot is, like, this source of, like, this altruistic character rather than, you know, robot going crazy. So, like, technology, you know, technology is useful rather than technology as a something to be feared. So I like the Data as, like, the natural progression of the most moral character on the show. And it's, you know, it's not just like, oh, I'm a robot, so of course I'm moral because I'm going to do what's in my commands. Like, he actually has, like, dilemmas, and he actually is, you know, learning about values. And, like, I remember the episode where he tries to learn about method acting, you know. Like, it's just really, you know. I like the
scene in the movie, Star Trek, I think it was Generations, where they put in the motion chip and it goes haywire in Data's head, and then he starts scanning for life forms to the tune of La Cucaracha.
That's fantastic. But yeah, no, I'd say I'd like that. What did what's your opinion on someone who's actually read the robot and Magneto's Daughter comics? How was that handled? Was it handled well?
I always thought this was like it was an extreme choice, and I don't think it ever kind of worked out the way that they wanted it to. So Vision was a character that was a lot of stuff was written into him to make it dramatic. One, it was a robot with a moral dilemma that eventually like betrays the robot who made him in order to save humanity. So there's always this sort of like betrayal. It starts off with this like betrayal of species thing. So, you know,
that's Ultron. Very interesting. Like you said, they might not have gone over nearly as well as they wanted it, but that's interesting that they're bringing in a lot of ideas about like, cause you know, X-Men's always had like the Brotherhood of Evil movies and stuff like that, like sort of using like in the movies, using them with Singer being one of the few like openly homosexual directors in Hollywood, using it in X2 is very much about like, you know, like the gay marriage debate. Like it's cool to have sort of, you know, the ultimate betraying of not just your race, but your species, you know?
Yeah, so there was that always level, but the thing was they justified. So Vision was just a very complicated character. So one thing is that he was betraying Ultron, who's not only his father in the sense that he built him, two, same species in the sense that they're artificial life, you know that subs, you know, that species. But three, there's this problem that he had a dead man's memories and personality programmed into him, and then that dead man came back from the dead. Because, as in old comics, you can never just kill off your characters. Oh, so interesting. So the character that originally his like memories and patterns are based on is a character called Wonder Man. And Wonder Man was originally conceived as an Avengers villain who was part of the Masters of Evil, like the anti-Avengers evil team. And he originally was killed off because DC complained. It's like, oh, you've got Wonder Man, you're just ripping off Wonder Woman. So
to be fair, DC was just whipping off Wonder Bread.
but no, it gets worse from there, because like years later, Luke Cage, his name was like his other name was Power Man. And then what happens after Marvel writes Power Man? The next year, DC comes out with Power Girl.
Oh, but
Stan Lee's like, okay, this is bullshit. So this is actually why Marvel has a Spider-Man and a Spider-Woman. It's not that Stan Lee thought the idea of a Spider-Woman was a good idea for comic books. He was like, look, if I don't put a Spider-Woman into Marvel Comics and copyright it, DC will make Spider-Woman.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know anything about Spider-Woman other than Lauren's boyfriend Zach has some of, I guess, like maybe 1 or 2 years ago's issues. And whoever illustrates them, they're gorgeous. Like, it's like the it's like those illustrations of Catwoman recently, the cover illustrations only, where she looks like Audrey Hepburn. Like, they're super detailed like that, even on the inside. I don't know who. I'd have to look it up. But, I'd have to ask Zach, because I don't even know what issue it was. I just remember reading it and being like, wow. Well, actually, that's it's interesting about Power Girl, because I liked the I read, like, the first, like, 13 issues of that new Power Girl series. Just because I was like, if I'm going to subscribe to a comic, I'm going to subscribe to the one with the biggest boobs. And
it's always a good idea. Go with that instinct.
Yeah. And it was cool. I dug it. They had the you ever see that? They had, like, Ultra Humanite or something that was this, like, boy genius who was, like, dying of cancer. So he, like, put his brain inside a giant evil monkey.
Oh, the Ultra Humanite. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They had him.
Okay, can I get on a quick little rant about DC? DC has way too many super genius monkeys. as villains. DC. So you've got Gorilla Grodd, you've got the Ultra Humanite, you've got the one that wears like a Che Guevara beret.
You've got the entire village in either Africa or the Amazon, I forget which, of ultra intelligent monkeys that have their own culture from
Gorilla City.
It's just called Gorilla City? Jesus Christ, DC. Try a little harder. It's like astronomers with the very large array and stuff like that.
Yeah, so yeah, Gorilla Grodd is from Gorilla City. Gorilla City. I'm trying to think who else is there. Yeah, there's definitely one who's got like a Che Guevara hat, and I really want to remember his name.
Have you seen those t-shirts of the Che Guevara photo parodied to be Cornelius from Planet of the Apes?
No, but I think this might be where DC got its idea.
Yeah, I mean, and it makes, you know, if you are a Planet of the Apes fan, Cornelius does come about becoming, you know, sort of the Che Guevara of Planet of the Apes, you know? Actually, speaking of good, I haven't seen the whole movie, but I was watching the very long documentary about it. The third Planet of the Apes movie, what is it? Beneath and then Conquest, maybe.
Escape.
Thank you. I was messing it up.
That was the best one. The third one was the best one.
That's the one with the love story, right? It's like a tragic love story. I still need to see the rest of that, but I've seen about 15 minutes of it, and plus, like, what's his name, Roddy McDowell's, like, you know, discussion about it, and man, he really made me, like, feel for that monkey.
Well, I mean, come on now. It also involved Ricardo Montalban.
Oh, he's the man.
And anything that involves Ricardo Montalban is just a wonderful idea.
Yeah, it's a shame that Ricardo Montalban and Christopher Walken didn't get a chance to be in every movie together. That would be the classiest, weirdest movie ever.
Oh my god. Wouldn't it be great? It's like, okay, so it's like the Wrath of Khan and his even creepier brother, Don.
The Wrath of Khan and Don, I love it. But yeah, so this Valentine's Day, this is the Thor's Hour of Thunder recommendation. Watch Conquest of the Planet of the Apes with your lady. No, wait, I'm saying it wrong. Okay. It's Escape from the Planet of the Apes, right?
Escape from the Planet of the Apes. So here's I found out who I was talking about. So of the DC super intelligent apes villain genre, you've got your Gorilla Grodd, you've got your Ultra Humanite, and then you have Monsieur Mala.
And then Magilla Gorilla.
And you know, Thor, I'm gonna have to ask you. You should look this guy up. Monsieur Mala, because I wanna know what you think of this guy's like look, because it's absolutely ridiculous.
Does he have a mustache?
I wish. I mean, all people that have some sort of Frenchish name should have a mustache, right?
Yeah, what, how you spell this?
Oh, Monsieur. That's Monsieur. And then Mala is Mallah.
All right, cool. I think I found it. say. Oh my god, that on the wiki page, that illustration is wonderful.
Okay, so it's so if you are like us who are you know, without you know, being in the same room watching the same computer, and you're out there in Radioland not able to see what we are seeing, we are actually looking at a picture of an ape, a gorilla with a red beret, a kind of Rambo like magazine I don't know, what do you want to do, sash? I don't know.
Bandolet.
Oh yeah, bandolet. Bandolet and red red beret holding what appears to be a dildo. But what is in fact a supercomputer with a brain plugged into it. Oh, and did I mention that the guy has like the gorilla has a handgun?
And he's looking like it's a very tender moment. Like he's
did you know that he and the supercomputer with the brain plugged into it are gay lovers?
No, you're fucking with me.
Oh no, I'm not.
Oh, that's amazing. Wait, dude, I'm seeing the word
dude. It looks like a dildo. It's used like a dildo.
I thought we were going to get through a whole, in honor of Valentine's Day, we weren't going to talk about bestiality for one issue.
Well, it's not technically bestiality, is it? Because it's not like a human being having sex with an animal. It's an animal having sex with a computer with a brain plugged into it.
That's a very good point.
So scroll down. If you're on the same page I am, scroll down to where it says romance. And you notice the writer who is behind the romance, Grant Morrison.
Yeah.
Now, let me tell you something about Grant Morrison. Grant Morrison is one of the weirdest people in the world.
Have you heard, Zach was telling me that Grant Morrison has stated in multiple occasions that he does not write his stories. You should not consider him a really good writer. He's good at retelling the stories he remembers from when he was abducted by aliens and they told him interesting fictional stories that he should write. That's his stated opinion.
Grant Morrison is a very strange, strange freaking man. He was the one that brought us an X-Men character whose mutant power was that his head was a star. And okay, so let me like elaborate on the Grant Morrison story. So you have a character whose head is a star, so he has to keep it in like a titanium cage around his face to keep the star from burning everyone.
LL Cool J, where his hat was like a shark fin?
Well, no, I don't think anything is quite like that. Terrible, terrible, awful song. But The Deep Blue Sea is a great movie. So here, let's share the most inspirational line from A Deep Blue Sea. I want to ask you, Thor, what is it that a 25-foot, 3-ton shark dreams of?
Having sex with a gorilla and a brain?
Nope. He dreams of freedom. He dreams of freedom. He dreams of the deep blue sea.
Is that where the title of that movie is?
That is where the title. There's a quote where it's like they're trying to figure out what are these super intelligent sharks trying to do? And then like somebody like stops dead and is like, what does the giant shark dream of? What? Freedom. The deep blue sea.
See, that movie could have – I've only seen parts of it, mostly just the part where Samuel Jackson gets eaten by a shark over and over again, because that still might be –
We are going to be okay. You're going to listen to me, and we are going to get out of –
it's so great. It's so perfect.
That was actually probably one of the best twists in like a horror slasher movie I've ever seen, where it's like, okay, here's clearly a character that does not – that shows no indication that he's going to – die anytime before the end of the movie, and then he just gets destroyed in the middle of his inspirational speech. That is just such a wonderful choice. So to continue with Grant Morrison, so he and his run of new X-Men, he had this character Zorn, the one with the star for her head, and Zorn claimed to be Chinese, and he came to the Xavier Institute and was put in charge of the special ed class. So Grant Morrison also invented at the Xavier School for the Gifted the special ed class.
So people with mutant powers but like mental defects pretty much?
Yeah, that had some sort of mental retardation.
That's as you know, as much as like I Grant Morrison's pretty hit or miss for me in terms of like whether I find his concepts intriguing or just like painful to read. That's a really clever conceit.
Okay, it's clever because if this was supposed to be something uplifting and we actually see, you know, follow the story of these mutants as they overcome their difficulties and learn to use their powers against not only like, you know, the social pressure to like, oh, we hate mutants, and against peer pressure where it's like you're not as smart as the rest of us, how could you ever be like cool X-Men? No, it takes a turn for the worse.
Oh, no. Grant, what did the aliens tell you to write this time?
The aliens told him to say, like, okay, so you start with this, like, inspirational thing of, like, the mutant with a star for a head who's, like, completely cut off with the rest of the world. Like, it's inspirationally, like, you know, oh, Captain, my Captain moments in the classroom with these mentally retarded mutants. And then you find out, well, no, he's not a mutant with a star for a head. He's actually Magneto wearing a mask. And no one bothered no one bothered to check whether or not it was Magneto underneath the mask, because obviously he said, oh, I have a star under there. You don't want me to take off my mask. And then he takes the retarded class and is like, okay, you guys are the new Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. They're like, yay, we're in a team now.
Oh, no. So it's like you ever see that movie The Ringer?
No, I didn't.
It was this movie where Johnny Knoxville, like, pretends he's retarded so he can win the Special Olympics. And, like, it was weird, like, because it wasn't, like, I don't know. Like, they actually got, like, approval from the Special Olympics. Like, it didn't treat retarded people badly. It just was a really badly done movie with, like, you know, a couple of interesting things where they had, like, you know, they found retarded people who were good at, like, comedic timing. So you're kind of like, it, you know, it's like, this is not that is obviously manipulative, but like this was you know, in terms of like a mainstream thing that sort of tried, like, the same deal, like, hey, look, it's gonna be inspirational, and then it's like, no, actually it's just kind of a, you know, dumb comedy with some retarded actors. It seems like this had similar high aspirations that then immediately they were like, hey, what, time for a plot, plotty plot plot plot.
Oh, that's just a shame. Yeah, so Morrison, it's just, he has good ideas, but he just can never turn them into anything that's lasting and good. It's always great potential, but never a great payoff. So he was the one that thought that it'd be great to have the brain and Monsieur Mala fall in love, because, you know, a brain in a vat in a supercomputer and an ape with a beret, that's French, should be having sex with each other.
Apparently the brain was also French. I just looked at its Wikipedia article. It's a French brain. I'm not sure if it has a baguette tumor or something, how they knew, but so I think we should probably start to wrap this up. So you want to talk really quick about X-Men First Class? I think the trailer looks awesome. I was worried about the yellow suits. I thought that those wouldn't look good outside of the comic, but they made them clever enough. And the chick they got from Mad Men to play, is it Emma Frost or the Scarlet Witch? Emma Frost, right?
Probably Emma Frost.
Yeah, is super like sexy. So that's pretty much all you can ask for.
Who's in charge of it right now?
It's both Magneto, played by some dude I don't recognize, and James McAvoy from Atonement, actually, which we were talking about last podcast.
Oh, I like James McAvoy. I was more asking, like, oh, so it's Fox, so it's not Marvel in charge.
No, it's, but they did get Matthew Vaughn, the director of Kick-Ass and Layer Cake. Layer Cake is one of my, like, easily one of my favorite, like, 21st century crime movies. It's what got Daniel Craig the James Bond job, like, literally. He made this awesome crime movie, and they're like, yeah, you're James Bond now. So, yeah, Matthew Vaughn's directing it.
Oh yeah, I'm watching this trailer right now, and I like how they're explicitly referencing the other X-Men movies.
Yeah, no, it's nice. Well, that's why I
part of the mythology.
Yeah, because as much as like as very very weak, like as the first that new Wolverine movie was, like, this is making up for it, because it's showing, like, oh, look, it's good. It's still at the same studio because we have the rights to this footage. We can make it be a continuous arc, you know. So I think that's cool. I like that idea. And They somehow got Darren Aronofsky, Fox did, to direct the new Wolverine movie, and he's going to be him kicking ass with the samurais in Japan. So that things are looking up for the X-Men after Wolverine had exactly one good moment, which, I mean, like, I didn't hate the movie. It was just very disappointing given how, like, especially, like, it was to be worse than X-Men 3 was going to be pretty hard, but it took the cake, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
because X-Men 3 had some interesting stuff about it. It was kind of like Pirates 3, where I was like, okay, if Bryan Singer had directed this, it would have been amazing. They just cobbled together a director who's a terrible director and, you know, a bunch of, you know, just like studio writers, and they came up with, like, an ending, and it had some interesting stuff, but it was just so dissatisfying. And then to have the only good scene, I thought, in Wolverine was the guy who played the guy from Lost and Lord of the Rings, who's Charlie on Lost, but I forget his name. He's Australian, and he plays a character who can control electricity, and he's this amazing tragic character. And like watching his scene, you're like this wonderful scene with him. That's unfortunately like his only one of his only two scenes. You're like, wow, this guy needs to have the first ever superhero like drama, like the middle of Trainspotting style thing of just this angsty character who like how awful his, like he doesn't fight anything. He just can control lights and his life sucks.
Yeah, I think the problem with X-Men. Okay, so here's my problem with X-Men 3. More than anything else, was how they treated Cyclops.
Yeah, that was bullshit.
And here's my theory about why they treated him the way they did.
It's a conspiracy!
Of course it's a conspiracy. So where did James Marsden... What did James Marsden do just after X-Men 3?
Yeah, he signed on with Singer. He moved to Singer's camp for Superman Returns.
He did Superman Returns with Singer. Do you think that they killed him off, without, you know, pomp and fanfare.
Off screen. Just because,
off screen.
You see his glasses.
Just because he stayed loyal to Singer.
I completely agree with that. And it's actually, like, as flawed as Superman Returns is, like, I feel like that's when, like, you know, like, Superman Returns is a flawed, like, interesting movie. Like, he does, like, Singer did interesting things with that character. The character that, like, talk about, like, you know, romantic expectations being changed up. Like, they have this, like, sort of, you know, like, boring but nice guy played by James Marsden. I felt like that, like, as little of a screen time as he had, it was a cool, like, they didn't do the typical, like, macho posturing between Superman and him. It was more just him being, like, Superman sort of almost being like, oh, wow, yeah, this guy's a much better, like, person than I am for my girl, you know?
One word, man. Kryptonite.
Yes! Yeah, I forgot. That also was one of the best things to happen in movies that year was, actually, to quote theeditingroom.com, Kevin Spacey's performance, they were using this as a criticism, but I said Kevin Spacey's performance in Grant was great because he apparently showed up on the Superman set, shaved his head, and then did the performance he would have done if he had been cast as the Joker.
Oh. Well, that's completely fair.
But I liked it. I mean, Lex Luthor is an interesting comic book villain, but I feel like you need a lot more time than an hour and a half to, like, get into his head. Because, like, he's an interesting villain because you kind of, like, especially, have you read Superman Red Son? I love him in that, where he's, like, almost like...
No, I haven't.
He's, like, more or less the good guy in that. It's interesting. Like, it's... He builds, like... Oh, there's, and in that, you should read Red Son. It's Superman lands in Soviet Russia instead of America, and he becomes, like, pretty much, like, Stalin's successor, and, like, Soviet Russia becomes the most powerful nation in the world under Superman. It's really interesting, and Batman plays part of, like, the, like, liberal dissidents, like, sort of, like, a Che Guevara Batman, and...
Yeah. What you mean, Monsieur Mala is not leading the charge for the Democratic Contra Rebels?
That would have been awesome. Or if Sky Ape had been in there. Did I ever loan you those? The gorilla with a jetpack Sky Ape?
Danny, I hate to tell you this, but you did loan me those, and I think I still have them.
Hey, that's where those went! That's okay. I'm glad you didn't lose them. So, you know, as long as you still
have
them.
Oh, I know where they are.
Yeah. That's so funny. I was trying to read Sky Ape the other day for the first time since I loaned him to you. I completely forgot.
Like, where's my Sky Ape?
Oh no, I was just
like, these were stolen.
I was just worried I lost him. I'm glad that someone else is enjoying Sky Ape. You heard it here first, folks. This is a Thor's Hour Thunder exclusive. So, did you watch the trailer while I was talking?
I did, and I don't know. Okay, so it could be good or it could be bad.
Director of
So
Kick-Ass, man.
I did love Kick-Ass. I think Kick-Ass did change my life.
Because you started wearing a scuba suit and punching people.
Well, I was already doing that. It was more.
Started, I meant continued.
It was. It's more about the wearing the purple wig of Hit Girl that was like a new thing that I added to the wardrobe.
Oh, jeez. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone.
No, multicolored. So here's what I'm gonna say. Multicolored wigs for all of you out there in Radio Land. If you're trying to think, what could I possibly do to, take it to another level with my beloved significant other? Multicolored wigs are absolutely guaranteed to just bat it right out of the park. And you heard it here first, folks.
Was that what happened with Rainbow Man? That story, they made a documentary about him.
No, no.
The guy who held up John 3:16 at all the games, at all the
Okay.
sporting events. Before that, he was the guy who originated that because he became a born again Christian. Before that, his goal was just to be on TV a lot. So he showed up at golf events with a transistor television to figure out where the shots were, and then put on a rainbow wig just when the shot was of him, so you'd see him in a rainbow wig. And that's Rainbow Man slash John 3:16. And then he ended up becoming a born again Christian and holding a C-list Christian musician, female musician hostage because he like was stalking her and is now like in prison. So yeah, that's whenever
Okay.
people quote John 3:16, that's they should know the
They're
context.
supporting kidnapping.
And supporting rainbow wig fetishists.
You heard it here first, folks. No rainbow wigs. It has to be solid colors, like purple, straight purple wig, fine. Straight blue wig, you want to do the Katy Perry? That's fine.
Natalie
If you start
Portman in Closer has the pink wig.
she pink, the good pink wig. Closer disturbed me. Actually, that movie disturbed the crap out of me.
Speaking of real relationships, I loved that movie because, like, even though it's like people being awful to each other for 2 hours, it's like people being awful to each other the way people actually have problems in relationships, you know?
Yes, it was so believable. It's like, oh my God, I walked out of that film just being like, how can I ever have a genuine, honest, trusting relationship? Because this all seems so plausible.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. I love that movie. I liked Christian Deegan, my buddy from high school. We used to ask like I thought a good question for people who we talked to had seen it, who weren't like and weren't there when we initially saw it was who do you think was the most moral character of the four? Because I get almost a different answer from almost everyone.
I don't know. I'm gonna have to go with Clive Owen.
Yeah, that's what me and Christian went with also. A lot of people went with Natalie Portman, but I feel like she was just the most surreptitious, you know? Like she was probably the least hurtful, but she was also the most like sneaky in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, I mean, she was a straight sociopath. Like, I think
But it's interesting because
so.
I still think she was the least sort of, I don't know. Like overall, I think she was the least directly hurtful, but I might need to see it again. It might have been that I didn't notice what her consequences did or don't remember them, you know?
Okay, so Jude Law and Julia Roberts, their
Are
problem.
the id, right? The sort of the base tendencies, right? Because they're always like punching each other and fucking
Yeah,
everyone.
yeah, yeah. And I think the issue one, like they are like clearly the worst characters, is that there's this sort of self-obsession there, and like
Yeah.
a completely like controlled. They're aware of it. They're okay with it. Where it's like, I don't care about other people as much as I care about me,
Yeah.
and I think the sto and their downfall is, I think, the moral of the story, that you do this, you're going to end up destroying other people and yourself.
Yeah.
And I mean, granted, you don't care about destroying other people; that just happens as a side effect.
Yeah.
But you'll destroy yourself, and then maybe when you destroy yourself, you start thinking, "Oh, maybe I shouldn't have destroyed other people too." Natalie Portman's just a sociopath. I don't think there's any. I don't think there's any like conscious like trying to do harm. She just can't help but, deceive.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
then Clive Owen, he's almost okay. So he starts out as kind of like, oh yeah, I'm just kind of, you know, average morality guy. Like, I'm just trying to, you know, do what I can. And then it, and then throughout, you know, like, he gets damaged and then he gets vindictive. So at least with him, you get the sense that his attempts to destroy are out of a sense of, like, righteous anger of some sort.
Revenge, to quote Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Palin, I love you so much. But anyway, so yeah, but the thing is, like, you think that of all the people in the film, Owen is the only one who has some sort of moral leg to stand on. Granted, it's not sufficient to justify the damage that he inflicts on other people. But you actually see, like, oh, you know, he was originally hurt and now is trying to make things right. He just doesn't know how to do it.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. And that's why I think that movie's so realistic, is you have people of varying degrees of morality, like, all trying to deal with each other, you know, the way life actually is.
And no one's right.
Exactly.
100%. Yeah. It's like, okay, let's figure out who's the least horrible.
Exactly. Dude, I really want, if you can somehow swing this, I know you're teaching philosophy classes at the Aardvarks. If you can somehow assign that movie and a paper about, you know, like, using, like, I don't know, like, what's it called? Noble Savages from, like, Descartes or, like, something. Like, I don't know enough about philosophy.
Oh, Noble Savages. They come from Rousseau.
Oh, dude, I totally put Descartes before D'Horse there.
Oh. If I had a drum set, or if we were in the same room, I would either, you know, do a ba-dum-tsh for you, or I'd punch you in the face. I don't know exactly what you merited in that bad joke, but
dude, I love that joke. I thought of that joke, like, my freshman year philosophy class, and I love any time I get to break that shit out.
All right, whatever.
So should we, I think we've now addressed a lot of different relationship stuff. When you said, hey, we should talk about relationships for Valentine's Day, I'm like, I like Rocky and Adrian. Like, I was worried we wouldn't have enough to talk about.
I mean, I like Rocky Horror. There's a movie about healthy relationships right there.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I mean, granted, all societal conventions are gone, but in the end, you get the sense that they care about each other and don't want to harm each other, which is kind of weird, where it's all about, like, transvesticism and, you know, having sex with men, having sex with men, women having sex with women, men having sex with women after they just had sex with other men, and men having sex with men after they just had sex, you know, let's just pile on the social taboos.
Yeah.
And in the end, they're all, like, swimming around the pool and they care about each other.
Yeah.
And it somehow worked, and you get the moral of the story is supposed to be, in the end, we can love each other and get along. And when the whatchamacallit, Riff-Raff and Magenta?
Yeah.
Magenta and the other girl. Who's the other girl?
Little Nell is the actress. The character is Columbia, because the shuttle, this isn't an actual call out, but it's one that I've been wanting to sneak in. The space shuttle Columbia is the only thing she hasn't gone down on.
Oh,
I know, it's awful.
Yeah. So when Riff-Raff and Magenta come in at the end, you get the sense of just how horrible they are and how horrible, like, what they represent is, and what they represent is, unfortunately, like, you know, the status quo.
Yeah.
Like, everyone has to go back to their home. Everyone has to pretend like nothing happened. Yeah. Everyone has to pretend like they didn't learn anything. And then you try to resist and we kill you. So, you know, but it, you know, the other moral is, you know, people in non-standard relationships can be loving and can fulfill the roles that we think that only a certain kind of relationship can fulfill.
That's so awesome, man. I never thought of it from that perspective. That's really cool, because I always thought, like, the end of that gets very, you know, heavy, and, like, you know, it actually feel emotion at the end of the movie. And I always – and you're right. It's because, yeah, there is this sense, yeah, especially between Rocky and Frankenfurter. I mean, you know, Frankenfurter, you know, kills Meatloaf out of jealousy, but you're right, it is sort of an evolution of his character to where – yeah, he doesn't want to hurt anyone. He wants everyone to be happy. And then his crying at the end, like, all he wants to do is, you know, Like, he doesn't want to have more time to, like, fuck people or more time to, you know, like, murder people or be, you know, a degenerate. He just wants more time on this earth, you know? He, like...
to enjoy what he's found.
Exactly, exactly. And then what is, you know, I think that's your Valentine's Day message. This Valentine's Day, everyone should watch, Escape, right? Escape from the Planet of the Apes and Rocky
Horror Picture Show. And the Rocky Horror Picture Show, don't dream it. I think it's the moral of the story. Don't dream it. Be it.
Exactly, because that's the difference.
And this comes from someone who went to the Rocky Horror Midnight Showing for years.
That's awesome. because that's to tie it all back together. I mean, you know, what do you know? Everything we've talked about, even Rocky Horror, you know, the relationships in Rocky Horror are more recognizable human relationships, as weird as that show is, than 90% of the, like, rom-com and, like, you know, movie crap where they just put, you know, where they just put in cliched beats about, like, what people would fight about and that kind of stuff. Because you gotta say, you know, Columbia's, you know, comedic but heartfelt song about Meatloaf being sad. I mean, you cannot say that a transvestite killing your boyfriend because his boyfriend had the hots for your boyfriend and your boyfriend was in a deep freezer. That is not a romantic cliche. That is new. That is virgin that territory.
Is that is the reverse of a cliche.
Oh. I don't know if we can top that. Maybe we should just very quickly say that Spider-Man is not in the Fantastic Four. There are four. It's not like the X-Men. It's not like the Who, where you can put anyone you want in it, as long as there's one or two recognizable faces. The Fantastic Four is like the Beatles, and Pete Best was not in the Beatles.
Well, we'll talk more about that next time. But until then, let me just sign off from Points Unknown. This is Balder for Thor: God of Thunder and Balder the Brave, saying the weed of crime bears bitter fruit. Crime does not pay. And frankly, the shadow knows.